Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you so much for tuning in. Now, before we begin this episode, you should make sure that you've listened to the preceding episode, part one of The Great Diamond Hoax of 1872. Hi, I'm Ben.
I'm Noel, and this is super producer Casey Pegram. That's him in sound effect form. There he is. There's his lilting laugh.
That's right.
It warms my heart. But hey, let's not preamble this too much. Let's just jump right back into the Great Diamond Hoax.
Sounds good. Arnold is still in the game. He gets another $150,000 because he was promised that if the mining engineer was impressed, they would get that payment.
It's like a bonus, right?
Mm-hmm. And so he sells another $300,000 worth of stock to Harpending, meaning that minus his expenses, he has made over $500,000. And how much is that in today's money?
Why, Ben, in today's dollars, that would be close to $8 million. And he was due more. Based on this arrangement, he had more coming his way. It was just an absolute stroke of luck that he had not been found out. And it just goes to show people kind of see what they want to see, especially when greed is concerned. You know, you might think you're doing your due diligence, but you want it so bad to be real that you're willing to kind of suspend your disbelief almost. And that's exactly what these suckers did.
That's exactly what happened. So he was smart, right? He was also the brains of the operation. If this is a movie, then what happens next has the song Take the Money and Run playing in the background. That's the soundtrack. Who did that song? Casey, do you know that?
Steve Miller Band, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So picture that, Steve Miller, Take the Money and Run. He says, look, I could probably sell more shares, but you can only get lucky for so long. He already moved his family back to Kentucky from San Francisco in 1872. And by the time people found out this was a sham, he's left town. How did they figure out that this diamond field, it seemed too good to be true, was in fact a hoax?
It was yet another piece of happenstance in a story just chock full of them. In 1872, on a train heading for Oakland from San Francisco, Janin, the mining engineer, encountered some folks from a government survey team led by one Clarence King, who was something of an adventurer, an Ivy League man from Yale, and a crackerjack geologist. He would actually become one of the most well-known scientists in California at the time. See, he began to suspect that the guy heading up Clarence King, the guy heading up the government survey team, that Janin's jewels came from this mine that they had just surveyed, this 200,000 square kilometer area, and he was concerned that a big discovery like that would call into question the thoroughness with which he and his colleagues surveyed the land for the government.
Yeah.
So they decided they were going to go back and check it out again.
Yeah, because again, they said it sounds too good to be true. And if it is true, that means that we're bad at our jobs. That's the problem. They don't want to look bad. They're not trying to make money. They're trying to defend their credibility. So they sniff around. They find the whereabouts of the mine. They're on the Colorado-Wyoming border. They start digging, and they find gems. So the guys must have, Slack and Arnold must have at least put the gems a little bit in the ground, right? Somewhere.
Totally.
Shallow grave, maybe.
Yes, exactly.
And these are geologists, though, we have to remember. So they find a ton of gems, but the pattern in which they are found doesn't make sense. Every time King finds a diamond, he sees 12 rubies. But when people dig deeper, they don't find any gems at all. And because these guys are geologists, they know that certain gems are not found in the same place. They don't naturally occur together. And they found these things that would normally, if you were just digging them out of the ground, you would never find in the same mine. And then they said, okay, we're seeing more stuff that doesn't fit. There are anthills that have rubies inside them, but there are also holes in the side of these anthills where stones have been shoved in with a stick. Also, it doesn't make sense that rubies and diamonds would be found so closely together. Hang on, guys. Stop the presses, says Clarence King. This is a scam.
Yeah, it's that aha moment for sure. The whole thing's revealed to be a massive fraud. King books it for San Francisco to get with his investors, his fellow bilked investors, to let them know they had all been totally screwed. So all of them in a tizzy. They find a group in town, and I didn't understand this, but they deputize them to back them up and go to the fields? What's that about?
Those were the days. Okay, so back then, certain people in society, imagine this happening now. Certain people in society, usually like sheriffs or marshals, can deputize citizens in the event of a crisis, or you need a gang of men to fight back against another gang of bad people, then you just find some civilians you trust and you deputize them temporarily. The best way to say that is, like, imagine if an Atlanta City police officer or a Fulton County sheriff burst into our podcast studio and said, you, Casey Pegram, I need you on the case with me. Something bad's going down. Here, how are you with a gun? And he tosses you a badge and a gun, Casey, and then he says he's deputizing you. What would you do?
I guess I'd have to accept.
Yeah, you're not a man to shirk your civic duty, right?
No, that's right. And I'm not much of a marksman, but, you know, I've been to target practice like once or twice in my life, so I guess I'd do what I could.
I have only ever held a 22 when I was a little kid. I really want to shoot a handgun one of these days, but I don't know if I ever will get to it.
I did not like the experience, I have to say, but I was like, you know, pretty young at the time, and my dad was like insistent on, you know, teaching me firearm safety.
He just wanted to make you a man.
Yeah, just, you know, not to do dumb stuff with guns, basically.
Yeah. That's smart.
Yeah, it makes sense. And also, I want to tell you guys, if you ever want to hang out, there are some pretty cool indoor ranges not far from here at all. You can rent some firearms if you want, and then we can, you know, I don't know, we can practice marksmanship, and then we can go get lunch somewhere. No? No takers?
I'm into it.
I'll go by myself. You guys could go with me.
I'd like to go.
So it's good practice for a zombie apocalypse, right? Actually, one of the indoor ranges does have some of the shooting targets are zombies.
That's cool.
So that's kind of fun.
Have you seen this thing that's all the rage now that the kids are doing? It's axe throwing?
Yeah, we've got three axe throwing bars in the metro.
They're bars, though. That's the kicker. You get drunk and throw axes.
That's terrifying.
Doesn't that seem like a really bad idea?
I don't think they let you throw the axes drinking heavily or anything.
I mean, if it's a bar.
I think it's like you can hang out at the bar. If they serve alcohol, one of them probably doesn't. But if they serve alcohol, you can hang out at the bar, and then the axe throwing is a separate thing. You know what I mean?
I don't know how you could keep the two apart, you know?
Is it a separate space? Like, are there axes, like, flying over towards the bar from people who have poor aim?
Or? Hang on. No. By the way, keep all this in the episode. Let's check. Can you drink alcohol and throw axes?
Where there's a will, there's a way, I think.
It's oddly inspirational. I want to see if there's a specific law.
Is it like a cat cafe where there's like a delineation between the cafe part and the cat part?
That would make sense.
And never the twain shall meet kind of thing?
But again, I think you'd have a hard time having those twains not meet.
Right. Okay. So there are a couple different answers. At kick axe throwing, think about it, the owner says patrons can drink beer, wine, and malt beverages, but they can only get a maximum of three.
Okay. So there's some safeguards.
No hard liquor.
They're looking out for the people.
I don't know, man. I don't want someone three drinks deep throwing axes around.
Absolutely not. No, I don't think anybody wants that, Ben. So what ended up happening to our hoaxsters?
So they are persuaded to return to the fields with their deputized party, and General David Colton is the company's general manager. In addition to being an actual general, He's leading this party, this posse. He finds some rubies on top of a rock, and he says, "It would have been as impossible for nature to have deposited them as for a person standing in San Francisco to toss a marble in the air and have it fall on Bunker Hill Monument," which was a very specific diss for him. And so when they get this evidence, these investors say, "All right, this is terrible. We fell for it. We are dissolving our company." Everybody in San Francisco makes fun of them because this has already been in the news. It also, like, imagine doing something that makes you look so dumb that every media outlet in the country spends a week making fun of you.
Yeah, it's true. There was there was even an article in the New York Times, which apparently had already been reporting on this and thought it was fraud the whole time. So there was a real self-righteous kind of "I told you so" article published on December 6th, where reporters wrote that the most remarkable part of the scam was that the perpetrators had succeeded in deceiving businessmen and capitalists so proverbially shrewd as those of San Francisco. And then several years after the hoax was uncovered, Ralston unfortunately took his own life. I mean, this wasn't just some mean-spirited joshing. I mean, this was basically like it ruined his reputation. In 1879, King, who was already on his way to becoming a legendary adventurer and geologist, he founded the U.S. Geological Survey. So, you know, pretty interesting trajectory for some of these characters. Some sadder than others.
Yeah, but we know the question on everybody's mind. What happened to Slack and Arnold, the original hoaxsters themselves? We have a story for you. John Slack was assumed to have disappeared from the historical record. He fled the country, or some people believe he died soon after leaving the mining fields, at least at the time. But in 1967, a guy named Bruce A. Woodard, who's an accountant that's obsessed with this hoax, says that Slack took a job building caskets in St. Louis and eventually moved to White Oaks, New Mexico, where he became an undertaker, lived alone, died in 1896, and left behind an estate of only $1,600. That's in Woodard's book, Diamonds in the Salt. Again, the guy's not a historian. He's an accountant, but he dug into this pretty tenaciously. He mined the primary sources. And then another article in 1872 that Woodard dug up seems to say that Philip Arnold bought a two-story brick house in Kentucky, and he moved his family there. He got 500 acres of property, all in his wife's name, and then became a horse breeder who also raised sheep and pigs. Even though Arnold and Slack were indicted in San Francisco for fraud, nothing came of it. And again, Woodard, the author of Diamonds in the Salt, thinks that maybe the investors squashed the legal proceedings because they didn't want to keep getting clowned in the news.
Totally. I can see that.
Like, they're not getting that money back.
No. Yeah, it's over for them. They just want to, like, move on with their lives. But here's the thing. I mean, this entire debacle really had some serious, like, societal implications. It was just kind of a sign that this whole prospecting gold rush mentality, you know, had a clock on it, you know, that it was, in fact, a bubble, right? Because California had experienced so many of these frauds. Think about it. Think about all of the frauds that would go with the gold rush itself, and of faking reports of oil, for example, defrauding investors of millions of dollars in the 1860s. This is from an article from Smithsonian Mag that goes into all of the implications of the Great Diamond Hoax. And in that article, Patricia O'Toole, the author of Money and Morals in America, A History, has some great quotes that sums this idea up. "I see the Diamond Hoax as one of a long line of scams made possible by the fact that the United States truly was a land of opportunity. Many a legitimate fortune seemed to be made overnight, so it was particularly easy for a con artist to convince a gullible American that he, too, could wake up a millionaire."
Yeah. Yeah. I want to point out, too, that Arnold was aware of this indictment and had a crazy quote. He told the paper in Louisville when they asked him to go on record about these indictments, he said this. He said, "I've employed counsel myself, a good Henry rifle." So he basically, that's such a Kentucky thing to say. Eventually, he does settle out of court with William Lent specifically for $150,000. That's the only time he ever did something like admitting he had anything to do with this diamond hoax. 1873, he becomes a banker. And then he gets in a fight with another banker in 1878 that leads to a shootout. Three people are injured. Arnold gets a shotgun blast to the shoulder. This is back when banking disagreements were much more heated.
Oh, yeah. He'd settle that stuff in the streets. Mm-hmm. And then, I'm sorry, and then what happened?
Oh, he just gets pneumonia and dies.
Oh, okay. That's a little anticlimactic, but yeah. It happens. It comes for us all. Death.
Yeah. Well, there is a mystery because we still don't know what happened to some of those hundreds of thousands of dollars.
You think there's a treasure story buried in here somewhere, Ben?
Well, they definitely weren't reporting it on their taxes, you know. That's the end of the diamond hoax. I think you're right that this was the tipping point or watershed moment that kind of took the rose-tinted glasses off people's eyes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was one scam too many.
And I think it was, you know, again, like we quoted from that Smithsonian article, these types of scams were wide rife, as they say in Brass Eye, a British comedy show that I love very much. But they weren't to this degree. They weren't this magnitude of hoax that just kept going and kept pulling more people in, and all of the perfect storm of circumstances that led to this being perpetrated for as long as it was, and to just bilk so many people out of so much money. That really opened some people's eyes.
Agreed. Yeah, agreed. And, you know, I think the big lesson that we can all take away from this while we listen here today in 2020 is that, by God, if you're starting a posse, Deputy Pegram is the guy you just can't go wrong with, you know? Casey, I have this vision of you being in, like, a director's cut of Tombstone. You guys remember Tombstone?
I'm your Huckleberry.
Yeah, yeah. Casey Pegram is the new Huckleberry. You okay with that, Noel? I always wanted to be the Val Kilmer too. It's like the best one.
But who is what is he referring to when he says I'm your Huckleberry? Does he mean like the pie?
He's like I'm
Finn?
Yeah, it's probably a reference to Huckleberry Finn. He's saying,
oh, I'm your sidekick.
Yeah, I'm the guy who'll hang out with you.
That makes sense. Okay. Casey, I'd love it if you would be our collective Huckleberry. Oh, you are kind of.
I'd be honored.
So now, which one? Am I Wyatt, or who would Val Kilmer play? He was Doc Holliday, right?
Yeah, yeah. He's so. Oh wait, then that would make Casey the Doc Holliday.
Casey's Doc Holliday.
I would only want to be Doc Holliday. It's the best character in my opinion.
Okay. I gotta cut down on my drinking if I'm Doc Holliday.
That's true.
Gotta, you know.
Don't you have the consumption?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. You also have a very complex romantic situation. Yeah, Doc Holliday had some. He's a very interesting character. He's the most fleshed out, in my opinion.
Not to be confused with the Michael J. Fox vehicle, Doc Hollywood.
Right, and not to be confused with was it Kurt Russell in Tombstone?
He was.
Yeah. Okay.
Wyatt Earp.
Not to be confused with his other Western, Bone Tomahawk, which is a whole different vibe.
Oh, I heard that one gets a little grisly.
A bit, yes. But check it out. It's definitely not for everyone. It's like a Green Inferno level gore and violence.
Got it.
But it's strange, isn't it? Did Arnold learn anything? He got away clean, pretty much. He didn't even have to give that $150,000 back. We're not condoning his actions, folks, but we have to admit that these scams and these cons are historically fascinating. Thank you so much for tuning in. Let us know some of your favorite lesser-known scams or cons throughout world history. We are all ears. As usual, the more ridiculous, the better. If you want to join the conversation, you can talk to us on Facebook. We've got a group called Ridiculous Historians. It's going to ask you a question when you click on the link to join. You have to name either Noel or Casey or myself or all three of us, or just say something that made us laugh. I think somebody recently when it said name one of the hosts, they say Cookie Monster. And I was like, that's fine. You know, we've all been a Cookie Monster at one point in our lives.
Yeah, I think they're probably referring to me, though.
I don't think so. I think you're being unfair to yourself.
I eat more cookies than you.
Yeah, but I don't really have a sweet tooth. No, wait, I ate a cookie a week and a half ago.
Okay, was it good? What kind of cookie was it?
It was like oatmeal chocolate chip.
Ugh, stop.
It just wasn't my, I don't know. Yeah.
Hey, if you want to check us out outside of the Facebook, you can do so on Instagram. For me, I am at HowNowNoelBrown.
And I am at Ben Bolin on Instagram. You can see some of my recent misadventures, and I am at Ben Bolin, HSW on Twitter, where I recently learned, I've been studying Mandarin off and on, I recently learned on the internet that the characters in Mandarin for penguin translate to something like business goose. So that's the level of discourse you'll find on my Twitter. I just want to keep everybody's expectations low.
Huge thanks to super producer Casey Pegram, Alex Williams, who composed our theme, Christopher Hasiotis, always here in spirit, and that devious Quister, who you might hear from him again one of these days.
Oh, yeah. Huge thanks to Yves Jeffcoat. Huge thanks to Gabe Luzier, our research associate, who, you know, I was thinking it'd be cool to have Gabe on the show at some point.
I would love that.
Let's do that.
We'll see you then, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.